Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything that we think we know about food. I'm Stefan Gates. I'm a food science writer, TV presenter, and a gastronaut. Today, we're looking at the relationship between obesity and processed food. Now, obesity is one of the most urgent and devastating public health problems facing the whole world. The World Health Organization started sounding alarm bells in the 1990s, but despite various interventions by governments, global obesity has continued in its inexorable progress. The World Obesity Federation estimated that in 2020, around 770 million adults were affected by obesity, and that's likely to rise to 1 billion by 2030 unless we act soon. It's clear that our changing diet plays a role, and many experts have singled out highly processed and refined foods as a major problem, particularly in the West. But what is it about these particular types of food that contribute to obesity? Is the relationship between processed food and obesity causal or just a correlation? And given the complexity of the issue, would eliminating processed food from our diets make much of a difference? Well, with me to discuss the topic are Dr. Amanda Gretsch, a nutrition epidemiologist and accredited practicing dietitian. Amanda is a research fellow at the Charles Perkins Centre at the University of Sydney. Hello there, Amanda.
Hi, how are you?
Great, and great to have you. We've also got Professor David Robbenheimer, who holds the Leonard P. Ullman Chair in Nutritional Ecology at the Charles Perkins Centre at the University of Sydney as well. Hello there, David.
Oh, hi, Stephen. Thanks for having us on the show.
It's a great, great pleasure. Now, Matt, if I can start asking you this question. So people probably don't need reminding of the scale of the obesity problem, but what's both fascinating and tragic is our lack of ability to tackle it. I mean, we know that this problem is here. We've known for years. As you've seen the problem spread, what has frustrated you most about the global responses to it?
So obesity is generally seen as a multifactorial and complex problem with many underlying changes in our living conditions that could have precipitated the obesity epidemic. This has prevented us finding a single unifying factor that has determined as the key of reversing the obesity epidemic. So ultimately, weight is maintained when energy intake matches energy expenditure. And changes to prenatal nutrition in early life have been shown to influence an infant's life weight trajectory, as well as changes to physical activity that have been declining. And there's an increase in sedentary behaviours, as well as novel changes, such as the impact of rising temperatures on the macronutrient composition of our foods. However, diet is one of the most important contributing factors to the obesity epidemic, but there is still so much misinformation and influence from industry-funded research, which thwart efforts to improve our food environments.
So is the nebulousness of the problem part of the issue, that if it's so nebulous that you can't really assemble data about something when there are so many factors involved?
Yeah, it can be quite challenging to assemble data that proves a single underlying cause of the obesity epidemic and shows why the prevalence of obesity has been increasing since around 1975.
Then can I just chip in there? So I'll answer that question myself, exactly as Amanda is saying, that it's a really complex problem. What frustrates me about it is that so much is known about the problem, and so much good research, so much effort, and excellent researchers are digging down into this problem. And despite that huge amount of research and effort, we're not getting much closer to a solution. That's the most frustrating thing for me. And as Amanda says, and you're implying in your question, I think one of the reasons for that is the complexity of the problem. And the obesity research community is too fractionated, too specialized in different parts of the problem. And what we really need now is we need an approach which steps above it, a systems approach, and looks at the problem as a whole and finds ways to bring together the different contributing factors and arrive at solutions.
Mm-hmm. And David, when you're suggesting ideas, do you feel that I mean, at some point it has to shift into regulation and legislation, I would imagine. Are the people who are able to put that into effect listening?
I do hope they are. Legislation and policy plays a massive role. I believe probably a leading role in driving us towards a solution of halting and then reversing the obesity epidemic. But it's a really complex issue. You know, how do you do that when you don't have a political mandate for it? So consumers in Australia, at least, and in other countries where the research has been done, consumers aren't keen to be told what they can and can't eat. They consider that to be the response of a nanny state government. Eating is a really important part of our everyday lives, and we like the freedom to choose to eat what we eat. Mm. We know how popular processed foods are, so simply legislating against them might work in the short term, but it's not going to work in the long term. We need more sophisticated solutions that involve interactions between government, between industry, and between consumers.
Mm. So we'll come to that, all of that in a little while, I think, because it's very important. And here in the UK, the obsession is anything that affects the market and might possibly add to inflation or an economic burden is seen as a nightmare. And yet people are quite short-sighted about it because they don't assess the impact of it on a longer term. But we'll come to that in a minute. So first of all, we're talking very much in this podcast about the impact of processed food on obesity. And I'm very concerned about the concept of processed food, because I think the whole area is riddled with mantras and cliches and assorted nonsense. So I'd love to understand some of the ground rules as you see them, because processed just means cooked, really, doesn't it? You know, I process an egg by boiling it before I eat it. I denature the protein so it coagulates. At the same time, I kill a fair proportion of the bacteria in it. But I assume that you mean something more by processed food. So, Amanda, what's your definition of processed food and why is it nutritionally negative?
You're right. Processed food is a term that can be applied to any food that has had any process applied to it. The most common term used for processing classification system at the moment is the NOVA ultra processed classification system. So they have four categories of foods. The first category is minimally processed whole foods. Then there are culinary ingredients, which are things like oil and salt. Processed foods are just combinations of those two foods. And then ultra processed foods are the ones that are receiving the most attention at the moment. And they're concoctions that include often lots of sugar, fat, salt, sodium, and are highly refined, usually have very little dietary protein. And then they also have additives such as emulsifiers, protein isolates, flavorings, colorings, preservatives, and other additives to prop up and make a synthetic food that doesn't actually, that's taste consistent, but it stops resembling the minimally processed food that it first came from.
My daughter emulsifies food when she makes mayonnaise. Is that inherently bad?
The jury is out on that, actually. We have been using emulsification for a long time. However, there is some evidence that the actual process of emulsification may be harmful and disrupt the gut microbiome.
Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned lots of additives. I mean, oxygen is an additive, nitrogen is an additive. Is the level of specificity of ingredients important, or do you just rely on a classification saying that something is an ultra-processed food?
It could be the amount of additives. So it's uncertain at the moment, but the amount of research and evidence is coming through that shows like all of the concoctions and perhaps the like the sum of all of the additions of different substances that we wouldn't normally consume can have a detrimental effect to health. So I know at least in Australia, the Food Standards of Australia and New Zealand is monitoring the additives that are added to foods, because there's concern that together they could be, some of them could be carcinogenic. And even though they've been tested, they've never really been tested as a concoction or together.
Yeah.
And that's the really important thing about ultra-processed foods. It's not one thing or the other. It's a whole manufacturing process in which, rather than modifying existing foods, you're essentially recreating foods industrially, adding all the things that Amanda has spoken about. But it's not only the additives, it's also the nutrients, those that are contained and those that aren't contained. So ones that are contained tend to be highly refined sources of starches, in some cases modified fats, reduced protein, cheap sources of protein. And it's that milieu, it's the combination of things that is the problem. Mm-hmm. And partly it's a problem because it provides industrial processes with the opportunity to recreate foods in a way that is designed not for our health, as are the foods that we've evolved and culturally developed to eat over history and evolutionary history. But these foods are designed for the purposes of commercial benefit. And then there's bound to be a disconnect. And that's the disconnect, I think, that we're seeing in the obesity epidemic.
Yeah. Okay, David, now you've carried out a major study on obesity and diet, and that's what we're really here to learn about. Can you tell us about the study? How did you approach it? And what were the headline discoveries?
Well, we took a different approach. I'm a nutritional ecologist, and together with my colleague Steve Simpson, 30-something years ago, we invented an approach called nutritional geometry, which is the approach that we applied in this study. And it's still an approach that I apply in my non-human work. I work on a wide range of species in their natural food environments, many of them primates like ourselves, and to understand how it is that primate biology interacts with food environments to give rise to outcomes such as health, reproduction, evolutionary fitness, and in our case, poor health and disease, or good health. So that's what nutritional geometry is designed to do. It differs from conventional approaches to diet and nutrition in that rather than pull the system apart and look at a specific part of it, for example, it's very common in nutrition research for a lab or a researcher to focus on one nutrient or the other. And then you get arguments in the literature whether fat or carbohydrate is to blame. But in actual fact, what's happening in problems, complex problems like obesity, is that these things are all interacting. As I said earlier on, nutritional geometry provides an opportunity to sort of a systems approach to pull together the different factors and see how they interact in driving the problem right from the bottom up. So rather than modeling or examining single nutrients, what we do is we look at nutritional mixtures. And the geometric approach enables us to disentangle the contributions to the problem, say energy overconsumption and obesity, of individual nutrients, but critically also their interactions. Because the impact of one nutrient is not independent of others. So we've shown, for example, that if carbohydrate in a diet is high relative to fat, it's one story. If it's high relative to protein, it's another story. So we look at the entire mixture. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing with nutritional geometry. The other is, rather than think about nutrients or foods or diets, which again tends to be the way that very often researchers in human nutrition approach problems, we look at how do you integrate those things, how do all of those things feed into the problem. And what this does is enables us to study the interactions between the animal's biology or a person's biology and the food environment within which they're operating. So we took a nutritional geometry systems-based approach. What we showed is that, firstly, we showed a very strong signal of something we previously demonstrated in randomized control trials of the effects of macronutrient mixtures on energy intake. And that is that if you dilute protein content of the diet, we human beings will eat more of the food in order to stabilize the intake of protein. So we've got a very concerted appetite for protein. And even if that involves overeating fats and carbohydrates, we will tend to regulate to the usual amount of protein. And in the process, a protein diluted diet will result in energy overconsumption. We've shown that in randomized control trials. We showed this now in a population context as well. Then what we could do is direct our question at the obesity problem. Is we could ask the question, well, protein dilution is contributing to the problem. What is diluting protein in the diets? And the key finding there was that ultra-processed foods or our equivalent in Australia, discretionary foods, are very strongly associated with protein dilution and energy overconsumption. So that was a key finding. Amanda, would you like to pick up on that? Is there any addition to that you'd like to make?
So really the great thing about the research that we're able to conduct was that it was we used an extremely large survey, which was representative of the Australian population. And we were able to uniquely show in this sample, which was collected using 24-hour dietary recall. So that just measures food intake over a full day for each participant. And we could see very clearly that as the proportion of energy from protein increases, the total energy of the population intake decreases. And as Dave has said, the discretionary foods, which is the Australian system that we used in the survey, applying it to the survey, were very strongly clustered in that low protein region, showing how protein dilute these foods are, even though we normally focus on single nutrients in these foods, such as sugar or saturated fat and sodium, to identify them.
Yeah. So to put it in layman's terms, processed food contains less protein overall. Is that right?
Yes, it's less protein. It's a lower proportion of protein, especially to fats and carbohydrates, which are very high, and they dilute protein. And of course, if you eat the same amount of protein on a donut or a beefsteak, where will you eat more fats and carbohydrates? By far on the donut. Yeah. And that's the process that my colleague and I, Steve Simpson, discovered, called protein leverage. So what it shows is that, as you all know, a lot of the action in obesity research is on fats or carbohydrates, and often fats versus carbohydrates. What this result tells us is, yes, fats and carbohydrates, of course, they're important in the obesity epidemic because they're the main contributors of energy to our diet. But to understand how and why they're important, we need to look at the third nutrient in the mixture, and that is protein. And we need to understand how human biology interacts with each of those components. And that's what we've done using nutritional geometry. Mm-hmm. We've shown that we regulate protein more strongly, so fats and carbs gets in the way. We will overeat fats and carbs to satisfy our protein target.
Yeah. And just so we're really clear, can you define what you mentioned that discretionary foods. Can you define what those are for me?
So they're defined in the Australian Dietary Guidelines as foods high in added sugars, saturated fat, salt, and alcohol or alcohol. Mm-hmm. It includes a lot of foods that you would expect to be unhealthy, like commercial burgers and chips, crisps, chocolate, sugar-sweetened beverages, cakes, biscuits, processed meats, hot dogs.
Yeah. What a strange word to use, discretionary. Why do they use the word discretionary? I'm fascinated by that.
It was up for discussion with the public and everyone in policy were able to contribute to the term. And I think it was actually food industry influence that ended up sort of maybe diluting it to discretionary food. But I think
they didn't want a word that sounded too negative.
Yeah, I think so.
Funny that. Okay. So David, is it pretty clear to say that processed foods or discretionary foods are a major cause of obesity?
Well, our research indicates that, and there's a lot of other research that indicates it as well. Research involving statistical analyses looking for correlations between health outcomes and obesity and diets in a population context. There has been one randomized controlled trial that substantiates this as well. And what that showed is that subjects that were in a residential facility where the diet was controlled had access to either whole food diets or access to processed food diets. The diets were pretty similar in all respects, except that one was highly processed and the other was more derived from real foods. And the subjects that ate the processed food diet ate more energy than the whole food diet, and also they gained more weight over the period of the trial. Mm-hmm. So it's a real smoking gun. It's pretty clear. And if you think about it, as an ecologist, I ask myself the question, not what causes obesity, because of course, lots of things cause obesity. You know, your physiology does, your behavior does, the environment does, all sorts of things do. But what is called the change, the rise in obesity over the period that the epidemic has developed? And if you look at that, you see that the key change there is the rise of ultra-processed, highly processed industrial foods. So it is a smoking gun, as I say, and it's not only once, it's not only the United States or twice, the United States and Australia, or three times the UK, it's global. And there's even a word for it, a nutrition transition, where traditional whole food-based diets are displaced by more sort of industrially controlled cuisines and foods than previously. And that's when these health problems creep into the population. So I think there's compelling evidence.
Yeah, because that almost becomes a sort of an evolutionary tool, doesn't it? That it's actually shifted global nutrition. So
absolutely.
Yeah. So the hypothesis sounds very clear, and it sounds, I mean, it seems like it holds water to me. But the link is you can't say it's causal yet, presumably. But you know, what's the difference between causal and coincidental here? What's the scale of certainty?
Well, traditionally, the mechanism for disentangling those things is a randomized controlled trial where you manipulate one thing, and that's all that differs between the different experimental groups, and see whether you get the outcome you hypothesized to get. And that's exactly what happened in the randomized controlled trial. And it's not just that. There's a lot of other evidence. Our study in a population context is entirely consistent with that. It would be difficult, of course, in a population context, we're not manipulating anything. So it could be correlational, but it would be immense coincidence if we demonstrated, not we, but if the research community has demonstrated causality in randomized control trials, you found the same thing in a population context, but it was caused by something different. Mm. We also know a lot about the mechanisms. That's another source of evidence. Yeah. And as I've said, part of that is a strong protein appetite. Lots of work on non-human species, both in the wild, shows that our closest relatives do the same thing in the wild. They regulate protein in that way, including chimpanzees and orangutans. And then there are laboratory model systems, like rodent research has shown that. You get all of the things that you would associate with the sort of health problems we see in humans in rodent systems. You get those physiological responses in tightly controlled experiments where diets are manipulated to mimic whole foods or highly processed foods to change the dietary mixtures, reduce protein and so forth.
Yeah. So, Amanda, let's look at some of the nuances of the mechanisms a little bit. Why are highly processed foods so attractive to us? Why have they created this sort of nutritional shift?
Well, if you look at highly processed foods, they've been manufactured to be highly palatable specifically. And they're also, on top of that, just receive a lot of marketing. And they're easy to eat in really large quantities. And they're often really cheap as well. So these make them prime targets for aggressive marketing from large multinational firms because it's easy to add value to them. And they're marketed to people of all socio-demographic backgrounds, but they tend to target people from more disadvantaged backgrounds who potentially rely on them because they're often more affordable.
Now, I mean, the problem that I have with issues like this is affordability and taste are, it's very easy to say that the food industry is grabbing and profit motivated, although literally since the invention of trade, food has been sold at a profit for thousands and thousands of years. Now, cheapness in itself has become another of these mantras where it's seen as a bad thing. Cheap meat it's been talked about so often that it's a bad thing. Now, there is nothing intrinsically wrong with food being cheap, and there's nothing intrinsically wrong with food being tasty, and there's nothing wrong with it being marketed. I do that with my kids all the time. I make the most delicious food I can possibly imagine. I do it as cheaply as I can feasibly do within certain parameters, and I market it to them like crazy. So you're going to like this because it's fantastic. So, but there is a difference. But can you unpick that the difference for me, Amanda?
Well, a higher proportion of energy from protein is more expensive. So cheaper meats tend to be fattier. So the leaner it is, the more expensive it is.
Yeah.
The types of foods that tend to be marketed have been carefully concocted, I think, to taste extremely good. And they're very energy dense. So chickpea or a legume is actually an extremely good source of protein that's very affordable. However, potato chip has been processed, highly processed and refined, packaged, and is highly marketed by industry that can charge triple the amount for a bag of crisps over a bag of dried legumes. Mm-hmm. And obviously for legumes to taste flavorsome, you usually need to cook them and add your own flavors and herbs and whatever it is that you're doing at home, which is so much more time consuming than just grabbing a bag of crisps if you're hungry. And then on top of that, the processing and refinement of them, in addition to being very low protein, they're very low in dietary fiber and very high in fat and salt. And that makes them just very attractive to consume. You can consume them very easily in large quantities.
Yeah, yeah.
You're absolutely right, Stefan. There's nothing wrong with tasty or cheap. Those are important things and always will be important things. But I think the reality check is when the evidence starts mounting that whatever is tasty and cheap is impacting public health and traditional food cultures and the sorts of things that are happening, then it's a different story. Mm. I mean, arguably, you could say, well, there's nothing wrong with a bit of nicotine because it's very nice to wake up with a cup of coffee and a cigarette. And, you know, who wouldn't want to enjoy themselves early in the morning? But we know what happened there is that the evidence with time mounted and that situation has now changed. I believe we're at a similar stage now in relation to highly processed foods.
And if we can talk a little bit about protein, David, that's really interesting. I mean, I think it's a fascinating idea that we have to carry on eating until we hit a protein target. In the UK, it's often said that we have too much protein knocking around and there are protein bars and people eating more protein than they need. Is this a problem that just affects certain groups and that they're the ones who aren't contributing to the obesity epidemic or is it more complicated than that?
It's more complicated than that because it's not the amount of protein that you eat that's driving the problem. It's the relationship between protein and fats and carbohydrates, mm-hmm. other sources of energy in the diet. So even though arguably, and this isn't, I believe, properly settled yet, even though there are suggestions that in many populations like the UK, protein is being overeaten relative to requirements, then that's not properly settled. What's being overeaten to a greater extent is fats and carbohydrates. And the reason for that is the dilution effect of protein and the strong appetite for protein.
Yeah. And there have been many studies on obesity. Are there does your work fit in with what we know already? You've mentioned a few other studies already, but generally speaking, does it sort of add to the pool of knowledge and does it conflict with anything?
Yeah, when you say, does it add to the pool of knowledge? The important thing with this study is that it's consistent with a lot of the findings of research that has been done in different contexts, including the physiological research, as I said, other population studies, I've already said epidemiological studies, randomized control trials on the impacts of different nutrients. So it's highly consistent with a lot of things. What it adds is really two things. Firstly, it brings these things together into a more integrated, unified story that, as I've explained, it illuminates the interactions between these factors and how the nutrients interact and how biology interacts with the environment and how different food category. It adds a more systems-based perspective, which I think is incredibly important. There's a lot written in the scientific and the increasingly the philosophy of science literature on the importance of taking a systems-based approach for moving beyond understanding to intervening and managing. And that is one of the indicators that that our study has provided, is to emphasize the importance of taking that integrated ecological systems approach. The other is also very important, and that is that there tends to be, because of the strong emphasis in nutrition science on the importance of randomized control trials for establishing causality, what caused what, rather than correlation, as you said earlier, population studies of the sort that we did tends to get a bad rap in the scientific literature. They're severely criticized for the reason that we've said, is that they don't establish causality, only correlation. What we've shown is that the role, what our study emphasizes, the role of these studies isn't to show causation. You can't do that. It's to show relevance. We've shown the causation in randomized control trials, but is that causation relevant in the real lives of people where they eat on a daily basis? That's the other really important contribution. That shows that it's not population data that are flawed, but you need sophisticated ways, innovative ways of analyzing those data.
Yeah. And to the layman like me, the hypothesis itself just sounds, you kind of go, yes, genius, of course, that makes a lot of sense. So there's a huge amount to be said for that as well. Now, let's move on to the trickier subject of change. Now, you're giving us more information about how this works. We've had years of knowing that obesity is a huge problem. We haven't been able to tackle it. So let's talk. I know it's not your job to solve the problem. You've identified the problem. But how about some suggestions for solutions? So first of all, Amanda, could you just increase the protein content of processed food and legislate that certain foods have to have a higher protein content? Or is that just too simplistic?
I think that would be too simplistic, and it probably wouldn't work necessarily, because the more we learn about diet, the more we realize that it's not just one component of a diet that's unhealthy, but multiple components. So one of the missing components in ultra-processed foods or discretionary foods is dietary fiber. And there are examples of ultra-processed foods that might contain some protein in them, but they can actually trick your palate into thinking there's actually a higher protein content that's actually going to be filling and satiating than necessary. So when you start messing around with nature, you can have unintended consequences, and the overall nutrient composition and quality of the diet would be compromised just by adding protein to sort of things like chocolate bars and then relying on those foods.
Yeah.
Yep. And as I've said about that randomized control trial that was conducted by Kevin Hall and his group, is that they tried what they could to match in terms of composition the processed diet and the unprocessed diet. And they still found that difference. And the difference between the two is not in the nutrients that you measure, but it's the form of nutrients and the packaging of those nutrients that makes a difference.
Yeah.
So you think about eating a snack bar where there's readily available, quickly digested and absorbed sugars and starches and fats versus eating something from a plant where those nutrients are enclosed in cell walls that make it much more difficult to digest and absorb quickly. Composition similar, but the context in which those nutrients occur is different.
Yeah. So there's a fair amount of evidence about the types of diets that are better for us. Change is immensely difficult to implement. Any ideas, David, about how we go about it? Or is it just that no change is going to happen without legislation and regulation?
Yes, I think legislation is absolutely essential, I believe. There have been many studies where processed food industry has adopted sort of voluntary codes. I've collaborated with colleagues in studying at least one of these in relation to salt reduction. And basically, it doesn't work because the industry is predicated on making a profit for shareholders. That is their job. And that's a very powerful force, as Amanda said earlier on. So it's policy is essential, but it's not going to be easy to achieve because it requires buy-in from voters. That's critically important. It also requires compliance from industry. And there's a big literature now showing that industry does play a role in policy making through lobbying, political lobbying, for example, making donations to political parties. So the system has become locked in a bad state through a dynamic that's developed over a long time. So we really do need to jolt ourselves out of the state that is resulting in no progress. How to do that is another issue, but just let me move forward to saying that I'm not despondent or too pessimistic about this because there are precedents. I mentioned earlier on the tobacco industry. If we look back in time at the tobacco industry, maybe 30 years ago, when I was a young, maybe a little bit longer, when I was growing up, basically it was the same situation as the food industry is in now. Very powerful industry that governments couldn't shift. But as the evidence mounted, that began to change. So that's one precedent. There have been some successful strategies in nutrition science as well, for example, salt reduction in the United Kingdom. That's been highly effective. And the way that that came about and the way that change in tobacco came about was through mounting evidence, incentivizing consumers, industry, and government simultaneously. And if you can align the interests through mutual incentivization between those three parties, that is the way forward. Without that, I am pessimistic. But if we can find a way of doing that, I'm optimistic.
Yeah. And as you say, the sheer body of evidence, the sheer amount of evidence could be enough to mark that shift.
I can also say that in my experience, industry, they're not evil people. They're doing their job and they're doing it well, arguably better than we as nutritionists are doing our job because they're winning. Their strategies are more effective than our strategies. But I can also say that I believe there's a lot of motivation in industry in the same way as there was in relation to tobacco to find a way out. Mm-hmm. As scientists, we have a responsibility to use the discoveries that we make, the research that we do, to help point directions that industry can take that don't compromise what is their primary goal. You've got to have financial sustainability as well as social and environmental sustainability. So that's the challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's an interesting point, actually, because you mentioned social responsibility. Well, a lot of companies are now being guided by sustainability issues. It's become a bottom line issue. It's become profit related as much as a moral issue. And change really is beginning to happen. So I think you're right to be optimistic. And that's a really good thing. So just my final question then, Amanda, starting with you, what's the next piece of research you'd like to see in this field? Or what's the next piece of research that your group is hoping to perform?
We're working on a few different analyses surrounding protein leverage to understand more of the mechanisms of how protein leverage interacts with different components of diet that have been previously uncertain about their role in the obesity epidemic, such as alcohol, and looking at refined grains and how these change our protein appetite and as well as the impact on total energy intake.
Yeah.
Which is quite interesting and is starting to draw together more evidence that, protein appetite is really important for regulating our total energy intakes over the day.
Which fits in with the work that you published. And David, what do you think is the next target for you?
I think the next target is to better understand the broader social context that is preventing us from moving forward in this issue, despite the overwhelming amount of evidence that it is causing havoc to health globally and the environment. We've also done studies showing that processed foods impact heavily on the environment, partly because every extra kilojoule of energy that we eat has to be produced somewhere, and those production processes have an impact on environmental sustainability. So we really need to move to a more integrated systems view of this problem and bring in interdisciplinary research communities. We need anthropologists. We need political scientists. We need social scientists, psychologists working together to probe the gaps that aren't properly understood yet, how those different components interact with each other.
Yeah, which neatly brings us back to one of your first comments, which is that people need to work together and there needs to be a sort of a multidisciplinary approach to solving the problem. Well, I'm amazed by the work you've been doing, and this it just makes so much sense and fits in. And I really hope that it sort of begins to shift us towards a tipping point where change really does happen. So Dr. Amanda Gretsch and Professor David Robbenheimer, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Stefan. Real pleasure speaking to you.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, I'd like to tell you about a series of events that we've got coming up. Food Matters Live Inspiring Nutrition is taking place on the 23rd and 24th of May. The events will explore the latest innovative solutions advancing sustainable nutrition. You can become a partner or apply to attend by searching Food Matters Live Inspiring Nutrition, or email us at info@foodmatterslive.com. And thank you so much for listening.